month, Jews around the world will be celebrating Pesach, or as it's known in English, the holiday of Passover, which of course is fundamental to the faith of Jews around the world. It's in a way how it all began, the story of Exodus from Egypt, the beginning of wandering in the desert, getting the Torah, going into Israel. It's what developed this deep relationship between the Israelites, the Jewish people, and God. A God that delivers, a God that redeems, a God that we can trust on and rely on, a God that spoke to us through Moses to lead us to the Holy Land. And this holiday, while it's so fundamental to the faith of Jews around the world, is also very, very special, important, even fundamental to Christians as well. We know that Jesus celebrated Passover. We even know it was at the Passover Seder that he told the disciples about his upcoming death. We know that Passover was in the New Testament and that Jesus looked at Passover also as one of these fundamental holidays as a Jew. And so today, as we see more and more Christians celebrating the feasts, going back to those biblical roots, they are celebrating Passover. They're learning the messages of Passover and internalizing them. So today, I have with me one of my most favorite people in the world, Bishop Paul Lanier, chairman of the Fellowship Board of Directors, and, of course, the pastor of Hope Church in Winston-Salem. And we're going to discuss with you today Passover and why and how it's relevant to Christians around the world. Bishop, welcome, and thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you so much, Ayala. It's such an honor, especially in this holy season of the year, to be able to gather and talk about our faith.
Amen. You have been one of the role models to me of really taking everything Jewish and integrating it into your Christian faith, strengthening you and your community and your home in your faith as you learn from these Jewish roots, from these Hebraic roots.
I need to say something to me that's very important that maybe hasn't been said, and that is this International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, and you in particular, God has positioned for a time such as this. Mm-hmm. In crises that people are struggling against, and there's confusion and there's chaos, and people are searching. And what you have done, I don't think many people would argue with the reality of Jesus of Nazareth. He was a Jew. His mother was a Jew. He had followers who were Jewish, lived 2,000 years ago. That's not about his spirituality. That's not about the content of his preaching. That's not about did he perform miracles or all of these. That's not about. There was a Jew. There was a man who lived in Nazareth. He was born in Bethlehem. That's known. He lived his life in Nazareth. That's known. He died outside in Jerusalem. That's known. But that's about as much as my people, Christians, a lot of us know. And this may sound very, very strange, but in moments especially like this, when we're getting to these glorious holy days of Passover, and then we'll be moving, you know, in just a few weeks beyond that, and we think about three times a year that the scriptures say that a Jewish man is to come to the holy city, and don't come empty-handed, and the Moedim, and the covenant calendar that God is pressing and speaking and engaging and revealing his great love and his plan for his people. To be perfectly honest, with Jesus of Nazareth, the man, and Jesus Christ, that for me is Messiah. That's my part. Then there are differences and we understand that, but we're not debating that. But what I would say is this: what a lot of Jews don't understand is someone like you, in particular like you, you, for our fellowship of hundreds of thousands of people who look to this fellowship, you have absolutely no idea of how much you bring Jesus of Nazareth, the man, to life for us. You have so much more in common with Jesus of Nazareth, the man, than I ever will. He woke up and looked at the Israeli sunrise like you. He knew what it was to be on the Sea of Galilee like you. I didn't know any of those. Those uniquely beautiful Jewish particulars of his life are so similar to your own. And it's not about what do you believe about this. No, 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 no. Just simply being Jewish and waking up in the morning. You have a remarkable amount. And so I would tell you, when we're thinking about the holiness of Passover and all of these others as we're moving towards one of the four New Years, that is extraordinary. I have to say thank you. As a Christian and in behalf of hundreds of thousands of Christians in this extraordinary ministry of the fellowship, thank you for not being intimidated. Thank you for not being afraid. Thank you for being so willing to allow us to know Jesus of Nazareth more.
Bishop Lanier, thank you so much for articulating and sharing so much on every side. This is a holy union, that's for sure.
And now we get to this particular discussion of Passover, and I think most Christians are familiar with it, what it's all about. And we can't really understand, as a Christian, Pilate and the execution of Jesus without understanding Pharaoh and the oppression and 430 years of slavery and inhumanity and brutality and starvation, and this voice coming in saying, "Let my people go." All of that. I cannot, as a Christian, truly grasp who Pilate was without getting Pharaoh. And so then for you to be so comfortable in your Jewishness to say, "Hey, I want to talk to Christians about this," that is, God is doing such a work in the midst of all of his people.
Amen. Amen. God is at work in all of us.
Yes, ma'am.
When did you first start learning, studying, feeling, practicing this connection between Jesus as a Jew and the modern Jewish traditions, or you can say the biblical roots of your Christian faith?
I was always more interested probably in what we would call the Old Testament or the Hebrew scriptures. That always fascinated me, and when we would see movies, which were usually terribly done on television, but still it was all I'd ever seen, and so it fascinated me. But studying as a student, going into the ministry, I began to see the correlations, what we call typologies, that when you would see this in the Hebrew scriptures, it was a type of or a symbol of what was going on in the Christian scriptures. But I'll tell you something radically struck me the night I saw your father on television, and the more I got to know him, and then he so carefully, lovingly, dotingly, not in a condescending way, he knew the Christian scriptures better than I did, and most Christians, and he would so gently help explain what I believed. And I had to say, "Oh, thank you, I didn't know that. Thank you for teaching me what I believe." And he wasn't trying to lead me in some strange philosophy or in some strange ideas. He was simply trying to tell me, "This is what you believe as a Christian. You may not know this is what you believe. This is actually what you believe as a Christian." And so conversations with him, studying him, and then that opening me up to so many others, helping me to understand the correlation, the roots of my faith, and how they would later be played out in my Christian faith.
Wow. And where does Passover come into that? As a Christian, how do you relate to the story of Passover and the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and Pharaoh and the ten plagues? Where does that touch you as far as being a Christian leader and how the Christian community could internalize and relate to it?
That is so thick. That is so big, so huge. And, you know, oppression and deliverance is such a big piece of our story. It's amazing what human beings can do to one another. And time and again we look in the scriptures and we see oppression and inhumanity and brutality and the people of Israel being stripped from their country and the temple decimated and the holy things taken and the intellectual property robbed of the Hebrew children, Daniel included, of being taken. And so for me as a Christian, watching Moses confront the powers that be, namely Pharaoh saying, "Let my people go," and how we as Christians began to see that, of course, ethnically, in a faith of a people, but at the same time it began to expand to realize all of us who believe in that one God of Israel began to identify with ourselves. Okay, I was not in Egypt, and so that particular story, but it kept replaying itself to where you then have a pilot of the Roman Empire coming in and binding and imprisoning and treating, so to where for us a Jesus would come in to say, "Let my people go," freedom. And the same dictatorial spirit that would come to bind and to wound, and yet this story of redemption coming and offering freedom and making promises that there's yet resurrection in all of this, to where you can oppress and you can wound as the Pharaoh did, and yet walk through the Red Sea, approach Sinai to receive Torah, to receive the word of the Lord. And for Christians, we would say the same sequence of events would have taken place at the same moment of an anniversary of that, to receive the Spirit, which would have birthed the church in particular, which would have been a final vehicle through which, not to replace Israel, but to join Israel.
Wow. It's all so personal when we talk about it in those terms. I always tell my children, the biblical holidays are there not because they happened thousands of years ago, but because they're happening today.
Yes, ma'am.
Moses exists not because he existed thousands of years ago, because we have to learn from Moses, because we have to learn from the mistakes of the Israelites. We have to learn from the lack of faith. And, wow. And you can often say, wow. I once heard a beautiful teaching about the golden calf. They just saw the face of God. They were just saved through the desert and taken out of Egypt and the 10 plagues, and God passed over their homes. How do you go and build a golden calf when Moses leaves? And I once heard a beautiful teaching that they weren't trying to go against God. God sent them Moses, and Moses was the one who was the intermediary between God, and they just couldn't live without something there that could differentiate and communicate with God on their behalf. They were supposed to build a mishkan, a tabernacle.
Yes.
And so this idea of the nuance between the golden calf and the tabernacle, what's the difference between the most holy and the most sacred and the lowest place? Simply that God told us to do it or not. Because they're both a place that God spoke through the tabernacle. You went into the Holy of Holies and God was talking there. That's what the Israelites were looking for when they built the golden calf. What's the difference? That God didn't tell them to do that. And so in this world, it's so relevant of what we think is right, what we think we want, where the intention is. And when it comes down to it, hearing the voice of God, let my people go. Give your chetzi shekel, your half a shekel, in order to count the nation and build this tabernacle. Now is the time that you could have the tabernacle that I'll talk to you through. The kruvim, the angelic figures that Moses went and received the word of the Lord.
Yes.
That all of these lessons that are so biblical, when I hear you talk, are reminding me they're so modern. They're so relevant. They're talking to all of us today. And by recognizing, celebrating, commemorating Passover, we're living those lessons.
And how dangerous it is to enjoy a miracle, to celebrate a miracle, to walk through the Red Sea, to get water out of a rock, and yet forget what got us there. And I was studying, and if I get it wrong, then I get it wrong. But even Rashi had said something about it being an embarrassing moment, and I asked someone else about it, an Orthodox Jew about it, was that in the 40 years, there were no circumcisions. And in the 40 years, there was no Passover. And again, if I get that wrong, please forgive and charge it to my head and not to my heart. But But when the children of Israel are about to cross over and to seize and finally take that land that God had promised centuries earlier, the first thing that had to happen was a circumcision, because the men had not been circumcised for 40 years. And there had been no Passover meal for that long. And if we're not careful, all of us, we can be so blessed and prospered and walk in the miraculous and see deliverance and enemies brought low and the people of God lifted up, and we get a revelation from Torah to where we become oblivious to how did I get here? The price somebody paid to get us here. This bread didn't just come from heaven. The water didn't just gush out of a rock. Somebody had to believe for this. And how essential it is in the 40 years to keep doing then what it required to get us there.
Right. It's so beautiful. And you know, the Israelites were scared to go into Israel. Because on one hand, it was the promised land. It was the place that all their destiny. Yes, finally, right. We're getting to our destiny. And on the other hand, they lost their leader, Moses. Yes. They knew Moses wasn't going to enter. And it was the place that no longer had revealed miracles. It was the first place they had to fight for. In the desert, they had the manna. Yes. They had the cloud of glory that surrounded them. They had the water that came out. Well, suddenly, you want this land? Go and fight for it. Mm. Go and fight for it. I'll be with you, but go and fight for it. Mm. And in a way, that's what we're doing today. That's what we've carried on from this story, that we know we have God's protection, and as long as we're doing His will, He will be there with us. But this is the land of work. You have to work in order to get the water out of the rock today.
And we've got to keep feeding the miracle.
Yes.
Keep feeding the miracle.
Yes.
Like you said, because if we're not careful, we start facing adversities. Mm-hmm. And rather than hearing God say, that land belongs to you, we start looking and feeling like grasshoppers. Mm-hmm. We start feeling so small when we listen to anything less than thus saith the Lord for us.
And all of this goes back to the Seder meal, the Passover meal, where we are remembering all these different points.
Yes.
We are going back and telling the story of how we got here, recognizing those miracles, recognizing the destiny, recognizing the work we have to do in order to receive God's voice. And I know that you've celebrated Seder meals. What have you gotten out of that?
Well, there's such a continuity as far as being a Christian and understanding. Yes, it began as a hallowed piece of God's conversation with Israel, but by faith, I as a Christian choose to believe that it expands. You know what God had said to Abraham, and all the nations of the world will be blessed. And God uses the people of Israel to bless all the nations of the world. And so to be able to sit at a table and to understand that the grace and the mercies of God have expanded to include me, and I don't have ethnically that same conversation, that same history, and yet the love and mercy of God, He says, sit down and participate in this at this table with me. It moves me. And for me as a Christian to understand that Jesus, as an observant Jew, would have gone to the temple, would have gone to Jerusalem 3 times a year to observe, to celebrate, to participate, and quite possibly it was that meal that he observed before the soldiers came, before he was arrested, and that meal, it's amazing how much the meal moments, those covenant moments, speak and bring change to our life.
Yes, it's... You have to have a way to manifest it, otherwise you're not grasping it. That just to have it in your head pass it on to the next generation, doesn't necessarily embed those values and lessons and teachings and miracles in your spirit and in your flesh the same way physically marking it does, which is why tradition is such a powerful thing.
Oh, yes, yes. And it's amazing to me when we look at the scriptures how many of our most holy moments have to do with eating, with sharing together. And really, if I look at it, probably I could say the first sin was when Adam and Eve didn't know what to fast. When God placed them in this glorious garden and says, eat. And these are covenant moments. These are glorious moments, but not that part. And when they didn't know how to step back from certain things, they didn't know how to observe kosher. When he said, stay away from that particular food, and they didn't, and that's when the whole drama began.
Right, right. Knowing not only between right and wrong, yes. but when something is right
yes.
and when something is wrong.
Oh, my goodness. Because the right thing at the wrong time right. is the wrong thing.
Yes, yes, yes. There's a blessing in Hebrew that we say, "Bisha'at tova." It should happen at the right time. So when someone's looking to get married, the blessing you give them is "Bisha'at tova." It should happen at the right time.
Wow.
When they're pregnant, you look at them, someone who's pregnant, you say "Bisha'at tova." Only after do you say "Mazal tov," congratulations. When they're pregnant, you say "Bisha'at tova." It should happen at the right time. Because everything is about the right time. My husband and I always say, if we would have met just a few years earlier, it wouldn't have been the right time. We wouldn't have made it happen. But we met at the right time. That we're both in the right place. And that's why kind of eternity could come from that. Which leads directly into my next thought about Passover, that so much of it is passing it on to the children.
Oh.
That's what Passover is about. So many things on question on Passover, you say, why do you do this? So that the kids will ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
The highlight of the Passover Seder is when the youngest child stands up and asks the Manishtana, the four questions. Mm-hmm. Why is tonight different than every other night? Why are we leaning? Why are we eating salt water? Why are we dipping? Why are we eating matzah? As a pastor, who I know invests so much both in your own personal next generation, dearest Paul and Caitlin, and as running this ministry of hope where I see what you do with the children, you are raising them up. What can you learn from Passover about educating the next generation?
Well, you know, that's really the question is, how does the eternal God, the forever God, engage a dying planet? He does it through generations.
Mm.
And the plan of God for our lives is always too big for my life.
Mm.
It requires another generation.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of his great names is to be known generationally. I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah and Rebecca and Leah and Rachel. I am that God. And then he even says to Abraham, I want you to cut yourself as a sign of our covenant. You don't cut your hand, which you could extend for your work to be multiplied. You don't cut your foot, so that wherever you go, territorially belongs. He said, I want you to cut the most sensitive part of your flesh, because from that place flows the next generation. And the book you wrote years ago about generation to generation, it's everything. We're always a generation, especially... Yeah, I mean, ethnically, you're going to be Jewish no matter what. But Christians, where it's built upon faith, we're always one generation away from losing everything. It's that easy to lose. And we're seeing it in so many places of the world now, where what we once held to be true, we were once fully convinced, we declared with great faith, there is one God, he loves his people, we can know him personally. And now there's doubt, and there's question, and there's deconstruction of faith, and all of these kinds of things. But what the Passover meal does, it rallies the people back around the table and reminds us this divine memory and remembrance. Who are we? Who is God? What has he done? What has he spoken to us? And how are we called to respond to him?
It's like when you talk to your child. Remember where you came from.
Yes.
This home has the values of... It's always reining them back in with those roots that are DNA of your soul.
Yes, ma'am. Yes. It's so easy for all of us to drift.
Yeah.
And we need someone that can be able to say, I knew you when,
mm-hmm.
I see you slipping,
mm-hmm.
and it's one of my primary assignments in life is to remind you of who you are and that you've never gone so far that the loving God of heaven won't bring you home.
Mm-hmm. So Passover is kind of God... realigning us with him and realigning us with ourselves, because what's the whole thing? Remember that you were once slaves in Egypt, that no matter where you are, if you're in a position of strength, if you're in a position of power, if you're in a position of luxury, then suddenly you have to remember you were once a slave. What does that mean? What type of responsibility?
And it's not a one-seated table.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Shabbat. You know, I had the most wonderful Shabbat dinner the other night. I didn't hardly know anyone, but that's the very nature of it. I'm inviting my friends who were inviting their parents, and I was able to sit there and meet all of these people I had never met in my life. And that is the nature of the invitation of go ye into all the world, be fruitful and multiply, take dominion. Part of that, the Shabbat is to me is a glorious reflection of the Passover meal.
Beautiful. So what would you say is the spiritual message that you get from Passover in a personal way, not as a message to the nation, but what's that spiritual hug that God gives you when you celebrate Passover?
Hope. Mm. Hope for me is the most beautiful word in all the human language. We named both of our daughters Hope, one who is the joy of my life and one who plays in the streets of heaven. And when it was time 33 years ago to start a ministry, I named it Hope. Not because I had so much, but because it seemed like I had none. We had lost two children. And in the midst of the anguish of hearing all the Egyptian families in their agony and their loss and their anguish and heartache and brokenness, we are well. We are kept. That is a big piece. No matter what has happened, we are kept. We are sustained. We are together. We are one. And for me, the Passover is, we didn't always get exempted from a thing, but we were kept in the midst of the thing.
Yeah.
And but also, we can't stay in the house forever. Eventually, if we're going
to
cross that Red Sea,
we've
got to know when to stay in there because of the death angel, and we got to know when it's time to get out.
I love that, and that what bridges those two together, knowing when to stay and when to go, is simply faith. That we know that God told the Israelites then, as a sign that you trust in me, first take a lamb, tie it up on your front lawn for a few days, then slaughter it and put the blood on your doorpost. Now, the lamb was the Egyptian god. And so it's saying, go against, rebel against this culture that you've been slaves to. If you're willing to trust me to do that, I'll save you and perform the miracles.
Wow.
And many of the Israelites didn't leave. They say only one-fifth actually left.
Wow.
Only one-fifth had the faith that they needed in order to leave.
Wow.
And so it's a message of knowing when to stay in your homes and knowing that God will protect you. Knowing when you leave, God will protect you. B'shivtecha. When you're sitting in your homes and when you're going on your way, have this be a sign on your doorpost. That if you are willing to sacrifice everything to bring God into your life, He'll be with you when you're sitting at home. He'll be with you when you're going on your way.
And Sinai is not coming to you. You can stay in this miracle and still miss the word that He has for you. Torah. Torah's waiting for you. Are you willing to leave the house that kept you safe last night, but will keep you from a thing tomorrow?
Wow. It all goes back to timing.
Timing.
It seems like everything that you're saying, Passover, from the beginning, the beginning of the Christian faith, of recognizing how fundamental Passover was to Jesus himself personally, all the way to lessons that can be learned today, is a real source of bridging Jews and Christians.
Oh, please, God, let it be. Please, God, let it be. Because we still have Pilates, and we still have Pharaohs, and we still have Hamans, and we still have those faces and voices. We have a choice. It's generations or genocide. And we'd better know how to bring our families together and to declare in faith, I don't understand everything, but I know. Don't ever put yourself in a position to where you have to understand everything you know. I don't understand how God created the heavens and the earth, but I know He did. I don't know how He took, all of the, for 430 years of captivity, and then 2.5 million Jews for 40 years. I don't know how it did that. I don't understand it, but I know He did.
faith starts where logic ends.
Oh my goodness, thank the Lord it does. Thank the Lord it does.
Wow. Well, Bishop Lanier, I could talk to you forever. Hopefully
this
we will
fun.
Continue talking
yes,
forever. But what's one lesson that you hope Christians learn from the story of Passover and from our conversation today?
Be willing. Be willing to listen to beyond the audible. Be willing to look beyond the visible. Be willing to believe beyond the understandable. Let God out of the box so he can let us out of ours.
Beautiful.
I would love to. Oh, beloved God, you are so good to us. There are no words to describe your boundless love. Only you could have created such a moment to where two very different people with different backgrounds and stories could sit in a room and say, there is one God. I thank you for this honor and for this privilege. Now we together pray for Jews and Christians as we're approaching this holy season that we would open our hearts to anything and everything you want us to know. Be willing to receive whatever it takes. Be willing to release whatever it takes to be in the perfect will of God. And for all of this, we give you praise. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Bishop.
Thank you, ma'am. So great.
Happy Passover.